Turn your radio on.
This is a download from Triple J.
Australia's national youth network. On radio,
on TV,
and online.
For more music, current affairs, comedy, and culture,
triplej.net.au.
And now,
at 6 minutes after 11, it is time to talk science here on Triple J. Zan here with you. Bernie Hobbs joining us once again, Bernie.
Hello, Zan. How are you?
Very well. For one last week as well. Dr. Carl's back next week.
Very exciting to have the big guy back in the country next week. But great to be here for one last time.
And we're very excited to have you in once again with your science broadcaster expertise. And this morning we have a special guest all the way from Canada, Norman Doidge, who is the author of the best-selling Brain That Changes Itself, The Brain That Changes Itself. He is a psychiatrist, a psychoanalyst, a researcher, author, essayist, and poet. He's on the research faculty at Columbia University's Centre for Psychoanalytic Training and Research and the University of Toronto's Department of Psychiatry. Good morning, Norman.
Good morning.
We call you Dr. Norman because for this hour, everyone's a doctor. So Dr. Norman, Dr. Bernie,
well,
and Dr. Zan.
I actually am a doctor.
You actually are. Yeah.
So you can call me Dr. Norman if you want.
I like that.
You can be the double doctor for this morning. Now, you've written this great book, which for anybody who's read, I guess, Oliver Sacks, they'd probably really love this kind of writing because it's based a lot on anecdotal evidence of different stories about the brain and specifically a new kind of science called neuroplasticity. What is this science?
Well, neuroplasticity is a property of the brain, and it's the property of the brain that allows the brain to change its structure and its function through mental experience, through thinking, through sensing, perceiving, and even acting. The Nobel Prize in the year 2000 went to a colleague from Columbia University, Dr. Eric Kandel, who showed that when an animal learns, for instance, this applies to human beings, in a four-hour training session, that mental experience of learning actually turns on genes in the nerve cells in the brain so that they make proteins which increase the number of connections between, for instance, nerve cell A and nerve cell B. It can go from having 1,300 connections in one part of the nerve to double that in just 4 hours' time. So this is really fantastic because it shows that the brain, which we thought of as a complex machine with parts, each part performing one function, one mental function in one location, and which we thought of as, or many people increasingly started to declare, was a hardwired machine, is really very different. The notion that the brain circuits are hardwired isn't just wrong, it's spectacularly wrong because, in fact, what the brain works, its modus operandi, if you will, is to be restructuring and altering its circuits.
Yeah, it's,
and the implications are just amazing.
Sorry to jump in like that, because I was just saying to you before we came on air, when I was did my science degree in the early 90s and we were studying physiology, and it was, you know, there was none of this plasticity stuff going on. It was all very structured. This bit does that. But from reading your book, and I have to say I'm one of about 40 million people in Sydney carrying around a green book about the brain and changing itself. But from reading your book, the brain is a piece of software with open source code, so it's constantly being changed and updated, and there's none of this really hardline stuff. But are the neurons themselves changing in number, or is it just the connections between the neurons?
Well, plasticity is, that's a good question. Plasticity is a property of the brain that exists at many levels. So in certain locations in the brain, principally one location, the hippocampus, we now know that you actually have neuronal stem cells or nerve cells that are stem cells, baby cells, which can reproduce themselves and increase in number. And they can be increased in number most easily by, believe it or not, something like long-distance walking, which may seem like a surprise. But if you think about it, if an animal or a human being in a hunter-gatherer society was to go on a very long walk, that probably meant that it would be going into a new environment and then would be learning incredible amounts about the new environment. Mm. So this is called anticipatory proliferation. And then the way to preserve those new cells is by cognitive activity. It keeps them alive longer in the hippocampus. We know that under chronic stress and in depression, the hippocampus actually shrinks in size radically. And this hippocampus is a very important part of the brain. It does many things. It helps us to map us in space, which, if you try to think in terms of, you know, the essence of life. You know, you need a map. You need to know where you are. But more importantly, for our purposes, the hippocampus turns all your short-term memories into long-term memories.
It's that classic one that was removed in the surgery on the guy who had epilepsy, like earlier last century, and they thought he had really severe epilepsy. They thought, you know, oh, we'll fix this by removing the hippocampus, and they did, but the poor bugger could never remember anything new that happened from the date of the surgery after that, and that was the start of us learning about those kinds of
that
roles.
Was the case of HM. That was actually done in Canada, in Montreal. And so if you think about it, if you want to take in anything new in the environment, you meet somebody at a party, you want to learn a new math concept, you want to learn something from the newspapers, you have to go through this gate, the hippocampus, which will take this new information, which goes into your short-term memory. But if you want to hold on to it, it has got to go into your long-term memory. So this is a crucial, crucial part of the human brain and our subjective experience. So that's another kind of plasticity. We call it neurogenesis because it has to do with growing of new neurons. But plasticity takes place not only at the gene level, turning certain genes on or off, and the connections between neurons and the number of neurons. But for instance, when you grow up in an enriched environment, we now know that you can get a larger volume brain. There's more blood supply to that part of the brain that's being taxed or stimulated. There are more neurotransmitters, which are the chemical signal, the chemicals that are used to signal inside the brain. And even the departments of the brain can rearrange themselves. So let me just tell you one quick experiment. Believe it or not, you know, if you look at a typical brain anatomy textbook, there's a back part of the brain which we call the visual cortex. Mm. Sometimes it's called the occipital cortex. What we thought was that large departments of the brain were kind of genetically preassigned to do one thing and one thing only, and the visual cortex processes vision. Now, we know this from lots of kinds of studies, but if you were to take any of us and put us in absolute darkness, basically a perfect blindfold, for roughly a day, that visual cortex would actually begin to process sound and touch. And you would get really, really good at processing sound. This is an experiment that was done in Spain by Alvaro Pasqualioni, who's now at Harvard. And the people who underwent this experiment found that they'd never paid any attention to certain kinds of sounds. They could tell you what kind of motorcycle moved past. And so what we find is that the way the brain works is it's very, very resourceful. And if you cut off supply to one of the brain's modules, then that cortical real estate or brain real estate will not go to waste. It'll be used for something else. And brain plasticity is competitive. In other words, it means that nothing goes to waste. If you amputate a limb, the part of the brain that processed that limb will be invaded by adjacent parts. And this gives rise to all sorts of weird things too, like phantom limbs. But it also means that depending on what you do with your brain, you can reconfigure it for other purposes. So it's really an incredibly resourceful dynamic. We map the world with our brains. So we map our body. We also map our body with our brains. We have facial maps that have been fairly well delineated using electrodes and other things so that we know roughly where most people have their facial maps, their sensory maps for the face, so that if you touch the face, that part of the brain will light up. Well, now we've been mapping and remapping the face in certain experiments on a daily basis. And what we find is every time you remap the facial map, it subtly changes. So if you have a very bad day and you're frowning a lot, or having certain sensations, your face the facial map configuration will change. And what we're doing now, the royal we of science, is beginning to apply this manipulation of brain maps to solve problems, all sorts of problems. There are many problems that brain maps, problems. There are many problems that have to do with brain maps. I mean, a simple example is these brain maps also process the world for us. And so children with learning disorders invariably have brain map problems. They're the neurons or the nerve cells, for instance, let's say there are many ways you can get reading problems. They can be based on auditory processing problems. Words have sound. They can be based on problems mapping what the words look like. They can be based on problems moving your eye across the page in a fluid motion. They can be based on problems in areas of the brain that have to do with decoding meaning. So what we now can do is we can do brain-based assessments of what's causing a particular child's learning reading problem, for instance, and then devise specific exercises that target just that weak area, and train neurons, we learn, fire faster, stronger signals. Children, for instance, with auditory processing difficulties, a very common cause of learning disorders, have neurons that take about three times as long to rest between firing as normal. And this can be completely trained back to a normal level. And the training often is just about an hour or so a day, and, you know, for 6 to 8 weeks. And we see not only does their reading go from really bad to, let's say, the third percentile to above the 50th percentile, but there are even spillover effects from this. And their brain scans go from looking very unusual to that of a typical good reader.
There are a lot of people with a lot of issues, questions, and questions calling up, Norman. So we're going to get some questions in just a moment. Let's get into some callers. Are you ready for it, Norman?
Mm-hmm.
The Nation asking you questions about the brain. Sam in Byron Bay, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for staying on the line, Sam. What's your question?
My mum had a bad stroke a few weeks ago and lost her ability to speak and is suffering paralysis on her right side. You know, what capacity does the brain have to sort of mend itself and recover from such trauma?
Dr. Norman.
Sure. The kind of stroke that your mother had is actually the commonest kind of stroke.
Yep.
Two things cause stroke, basically. We have a clot in the arterial branches that supply the brain with oxygen and fuel, or there's a bleed. And because the brain has thousands and thousands of departments,
yep,
every stroke is clinically very different. But in this very common kind of stroke, luckily, there have been major, major breakthroughs by Dr. Edward Taub in Birmingham, Alabama. Here's what happens in a stroke. When a person has a stroke, the brain goes into a period of shock.
Yep.
And you can't really use it at all. You try to use your arm on multiple occasions. It doesn't work, so your brain kind of concludes it won't work. Now, we've done thousands of experiments that have shown, I mean, the Royal We of Science, that have shown it's a use-it-or-lose-it brain.
Yep.
Dr. Edward Taub figured out the following. So just think about this principle that maybe what is happening in some people who have strokes is because they try to use their arm when their brain is in shock, they develop something he called learned non-use. And what typically happens is rehabilitation counselors say, well, start using your good arm and leave your affected arm alone. Now, if it's a use it or lose it brain, you can imagine what's going to happen.
Yeah.
The good arm will get stronger marginally because it's just doing what it's always done. And the bad arm has no chance of getting better. So what he does, and I'm not suggesting you do this at home. I'm suggesting you go to his website and look it up. What he had the ingenuity to do was to take the good arm and put it in a sling. But he doesn't start working till really after a number of months have passed by and the brain shock is completely over. And then he incrementally trains the weakened arm. And he has been able to take people who are completely dependent on others and have virtually no movement in that arm,
yep,
and bring them to the point where they can actually function. And his treatment, which takes place in Alabama, called, yep, constraint-induced therapy,
yep,
takes only 2 weeks initially, and then and Michael Bernstein was a surgeon who was one of his very first patients, actually, because he lived in Alabama. He had a total paralysis on one side.
Yep.
He lost all fine motor movements, of course. He lost all movements. And he said that when he was doing this training with Dr. Taub, he felt he could get better by the hour, but it was very taxing and exacting.
Yep.
And he got to the point where he was back in the office as an eye surgeon, functioning very well, and he even got to playing the classical piano, which is something he used to do. So this is, and there have been very, very good studies of the efficacy of the Taub treatment, and it doesn't just work for stroke. It's the model of this, that there's a brain injury and there's a period of learned non-use, and then you have to do incremental training by experts, applies to a number of conditions. Taub has now applied this to cerebral palsy, children born who, it's like they've had strokes or damaged brain trauma in their delivery or perhaps in the womb, have benefited, and they're very plastic. He has applied this anecdotally to veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, some people with MS, and people with some other conditions as well that have had some diffuse brain injury. Now, for this to work, you need a couple of things in place, okay? To do this, you have to be able to pay attention, and some people have strokes or brain damage where they can't. And you have to be motivated because it's really hard work and it's quite exhausting. So it won't work for everybody all the time. Now, as for the speech, there's someone in Germany who has applied his techniques to speech, and that's a long story is how it works. Unfortunately, the treatment is for people who speak German, but at some point...
you could end up speaking German afterwards.
Yeah, you might end up come out speaking
German.
You'll
never play the violin again.
Yeah, but... it would be great to hear that physiotherapists have made the pilgrimage to in Australia, are making the pilgrimage to Birmingham, Alabama, to learn this wonderful, wonderful treatment for an illness that affects so many people.
That's true. Yeah.
You can contact them.
Can we just clarify one thing there, Norman, just so we don't get flooded with people who've been bad car accidents and had spinal injury or something? This is only if you've had some brain injury. It's not if you've had a severed spine or anything. You can't fix that kind of paralysis.
Well, not at this point, but there is a – Dr. Taub has told me that there – is one group in Boston, Massachusetts, I think the hospital's called Spalding, that has been working to see if there's learned non-use in the spine. And they've been getting some results. I don't know how good they are. That is really, really on the sort of edge of practice. But, you know, people know from Christopher Reeve, the guy who played Superman, who exercised relentlessly, he wasn't using the Taub technique, that there was some modest recovery that he was able to have for himself. He got some feeling back in his fingers and some improved movement. So the issue of spinal plasticity is that there is some plasticity in the spine, but there are many, many different approaches people are taking to that, including they're just stem cell kinds of manipulations and very complicated things.
Yeah. Hey, Sam, we've got to move on to another call because there are a lot of people waiting, but thank you for your call. Chris in Sydney, good morning.
Morning.
What's your question for Dr. Norman and Dr. Burney and, well, for me as well?
My question's got to do with memory loss and alcohol. I've got a pretty bad memory to start with. I'm just wondering if there's any way I could stop doing it when I go out. I'll stop losing memory of what's happening.
So you're saying that you're losing the memory of what happened the night before or just in general?
Nah, not before. And then it's I don't know if it's getting worse or if I'm just noticing a lot more, but my memory in general is pretty bad.
How old are you, Chris?
I'm 22.
Dr. Norman?
Well, I can't diagnose Chris because, I don't know exactly what's happening there. And some people have special sensitivities to alcohol, and the solution there is simply don't drink. You know, alcohol does a lot of bad things. It's a depressant over time. It's addictive for a subgroup of the population. But it also tends to disturb the architecture of your sleep. That's just the organization of all the different stages of sleep. And sleep is necessary for consolidating memories of the day before. We now know this, and this is a plasticity issue. I mean, at night, there are all sorts of things that are moving around inside your head, if you will. I mean, signals that are moving around, and memories of the previous day that are important are being consolidated, meaning the connections between the neurons that are process those memories are reinforced for the important ones. And so if you drink too much, you're not going to have a good consolidation at night.
All right.
Thanks. For the,
Thanks for the call, Chris.
Thanks,
guys. See you later. We're talking about neuroplasticity, which is the ability for the brain to rewire itself, heal itself almost, well, pretty much. Robert in Warrigal, good morning.
Good morning, doctors.
Hello.
I just have a quick question for Dr. Norton there about what he was saying earlier with, I think it was the cortex of the brain which sees or processes vision, and when patients were blindfolded, that then got turned to, say, hearing, and whether or not by maybe blindfolding students while they learnt music or something like that would be able to increase their ability to hear the notes more clearly and have a more astute music ear.
Well, it's speculation because it has, you know, I haven't seen it done with a class, but I think based on that previous experiment, it probably would. You know, it's interesting. There's this tradition, for instance, that Homer, the great ancient Greek poet, was blind. And there was this tradition of the blind poet that went back. And in my research, there were even groups that actually did try to wear blindfolds to do things like dancing and music. So I expect that there would be an uptick in learning. It would be an interesting experiment, but some parents might object to it. It's the kind of weird thing I might do.
You blindfold your own children just to see what happened?
No, myself. I blindfold myself.
Thanks for the call, Robert.
Cheers.
See you later.
And then my children would kick me and sort of put things in my way so I'd fall over.
It draws funny eyebrows on your forehead and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Michael in Newcastle, you've got a question about sexuality.
I do. How you going?
Good, thanks. What's your question?
Sort of sexuality has always been assumed, or by most people, I think, to be almost set from birth, unless, you know, sort of trauma during... another explanation is through childhood or whatever.
When you say sexuality, do you mean sexual preference?
Yeah. I mean sexual preference, or even, I guess, even paraphilias. I assume the doctor knows something about. But my question for the doctor is: how does neuroplasticity, or how strongly could that affect sexuality? So, I've always thought that, you know, by the time you're 15 or 16, you can be pretty well sure of your sexuality. Can that be changed?
So
afterwards, by
can you learn to be gay or whether straight?
That seems very foreign to me. I wouldn't think so. But, you know.
Dr. Norman?
Yeah. Well, look, my book is about areas that have been studied in detail, and I know of no studies in detail that examine whether the new neuroplastic interventions could change sexual orientation. But let me tell you what I sort of do know by observation and theory. I mean, Freud's theory about this was, I think, actually a pretty good one, which is that there's a whole range. Some people seem to be just genetically predetermined to be straight, some to be homosexual. There are some people in the middle who can be influenced by development. And depending on what happens, this is such a politicized thing, but I think everybody who's an adult who has a lot of friends probably knows something I know that I've seen amongst friends, colleagues, and amongst patients, which is sometimes people do seem to spontaneously change sexual orientation. It happens. It's not common, but there are people I've met who for a period of their life were thought themselves to be straight, who then became gay, and vice versa. In therapy, on rare occasions, you see people who go into therapy not to change their sexual orientation, but just to get help with things and analyze things.
Sure.
And there was a study in the States that showed about 23% of people who were gay spontaneously became heterosexual. There are other therapies that are coercive and say, you want to get rid of it, I will sort of help you get rid of it and treat it like get you to be frightened of your sexuality.
Yeah.
But in what I'm describing, these weren't directive. There are also people who go in heterosexuals who sometimes discover that they're gay. I'm not talking, by the way, here about bisexual people who have known all along they're attracted to both sexes. So I think a mature, honest discussion acknowledges that though it's rare, from time to time, people do seem to change orientation, but it's not everybody. Mm. And when we say that sexual orientation is very frequently biological, that doesn't necessarily mean it's genetic. it's important to understand that there were very interesting studies that came out of Canada that showed that the more older brothers you had, the higher likelihood you had of being a male homosexual. And that may have been related to interactions with antibodies and genes. There's a book called Nature via Nurture, I think is the title, that goes into this. It's a very good book. Now, it does seem that experience influences to some degree, I think there is evidence, the sexual tastes of all of us. And so I'm now broadening the discussion, not to talk about sexual orientation, but sexuality in general. You know, and there is this phenomenon, of course, of acquired tastes, right? Like children are born repelled by liver pate and coffee and smelly
and the thought of their parents having sex.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't thinking of that, but I guess the thought of their parents having sex while eating pate and having Munster burger cheese would be particularly a turnoff. But there are all these things that we seem biologically wired to be repelled by, and it seems to be off decaying things, which for obvious reasons, that by the time we hit adulthood and try to become sophisticated, we'll pay dearly for in French restaurants and so on and so forth. And but that is the effect of plasticity. You know, we also see sexual plasticity operating, for instance, in people who are traumatized that the caller alluded to. I describe a case of a man whose mother was an alcoholic, and she was extremely seductive. She also had a mental illness, and she could be very difficult in withdrawing her love and very tempestuous. And as he developed a taste, he acquired a taste for romantic partners who were, you know, very much like her, and there was a lot of sadomasochistic stuff going on in the interaction. We see that all the time. I mean, there are all sorts of reasons we don't want to hear about children being abused, and one of them is it messes them up sexually, but it also can influence in some way their taste. In the book, I describe the influence of, you know, the new sort of kind of internet pornography, which I and other clinicians have noticed has been having a very powerful impact on some patients, not necessarily everybody, and more so people with addictive tendencies. But, you know, you can get addicted, of course, to all sorts of non-drug-like things. You can get addicted to gambling or even running, it seems. And what seems to be happening is, you know, in the 90s, we started to hear more and more cases, which have since been quite well documented, of men who, just for a lark, would go onto a porn site, or someone would send them a porn picture, and then they'd find their way to these sites where there would be, you know, hundreds and hundreds of different pictures organized around themes. In the book, I talk about a man who started to look at these and spend more and more time, and a lot of it was curious and very, very weird things, he thought. And at a certain point, he got to a spanking site, and then he just couldn't stop. And he would spend hours and hours, you know, while everybody else was sleeping on this site. And it was hooking into something. Now, if you think about spanking, that's not such an unusual kind of theme to be in there. And it evokes early childhood and childhood punishment. There would be one of these examples where there might have been some spanking going on.
But are you saying that watching it repeatedly rewires the brain in order to make you more attracted to that idea?
Yeah, before that, he wasn't attracted to spanking images in sexuality, but it got hooked into his adult sexuality and his pleasure centers, and then he was really seriously hooked on it.
Mm.
And so that's an acquired taste, and over we hear the same story, that these men's sexual tastes get hijacked, and even though they may have partners, and partners they find attractive, that's why they were drawn to them in the first place,
they
start to lose their sexual attraction for their partners. So there is an acquired taste and plasticity working in a kind of unconscious or automatic way, and not necessarily in a way that the person's pleased about. In fact, none of these men were pleased by it.
Sure.
Michael in Newcastle, I think that answers your question a little bit and a little bit more. You've got lots to think about there.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call, Michael. No worries. We have Yasmin in Sydney on the line. Hello, Yasmin.
Hi, guys. How are you going?
Good, thanks. Good. What's your question?
Look, I've just got a question. As everyone sort of knows, that we all have, you know, we only use sort of 8% of our brain. now knowing that we have this, you know, this plasticity ability to be able to change our brain, what does that mean in terms of our use of our brain? And, you know, does this explain things like telekinesis and things like that?
So it's a common question, how much of our brain we actually use, our potential. What's the answer, Norman?
Well, for about 100 years, people have been just repeating this, not based on any scientific data, that we only use 10% is what you usually hear of our brain. It's kind of like a folktale. I would say that it's the spirit of that statement is correct, and I'll explain why, but the letter of the statement is wrong. Remember how I said if your arm is cut off, the part of the brain that processed sensation or movement for the arm is taken over by other parts of the brain. Mm-hmm. So no part of your brain is ever fallow or not used. So whatever you do in your day-to-day activities gets devoted to your brain. And if you watch TV all day long, your brain is going to look like a TV. I mean, it's going to be processing television. So we don't, in practice, waste any of it. But it's true in spirit insofar as now that we know that the brain can reorganize its departments in significant ways, with a lot of mental effort, you can do much more with your brain than you think you can. It's much more flexible than you think. And I go into that in the book.
Thanks for the call, Yasmin.
Great, thanks very much.
See you later. David in Townsville, good morning.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks. What's your question?
I've just got a quick question. I know you were talking earlier about short-term to long-term memory transition. I was just wondering, is there anything that a person can do to train the brain and the body to make the transition from a short-term to a long-term memory more effective?
Well, you learn about the doses that are required for learning. I mean, obviously, there are things everybody knows. You need a good night's sleep and so on and so forth. But in my book, I describe experiments where people are working on converting short-term memories to long. It's like cramming for a test. You know, if you just put all the information in one or two times the night before the test and then you don't repeat it, you will lose it, or you'll lose most of it. And it's really a matter of practice, and it depends on the activity. And in the book, I go through various different paradigms. But the chemistry of a short-term memory is slightly different than the chemistry of the long-term memory. But the truth is, the key is practice over multiple days.
There you go, David.
With good sleep.
Thanks for the call,
There's
David.
There's no shortcut, man. Sorry.
Yeah, it's always practice makes perfect. It's true. Dr. Norman, over the last hour, we've had quite a few calls from parents of children diagnosed with autism. Can you let us know about any of the research you've done on work with autism and neuroplasticity, whether those two are linked?
Yeah, it's research I've investigated. Look, I can't say that there is a brand new treatment yet for autism simply, but intriguing things have been discovered. The first thing for all listeners to know is autism is one word, but it describes many, many different conditions. Many different things can lead to an autistic kind of picture, and every autistic child is different. So there are treatments out there already that target some of the symptoms for behavioral things, but there are suggestions that the autistic brain in some ways is an overconnected, overplastic brain. They come from this. Some autistic people, for instance, not most, but some have extraordinary abilities, the savant-like skills. Mm. It's as though their brains are just better at calculating. Mm. Two, they tend to have higher rates of epilepsy. In epilepsy, you basically have the brain over-communicating. Some neurons fire, and then they set a storm of activity going on. Three, the part of the brain that conducts signals, which is the white matter, there's more of it in an autistic brain. They have bigger brains, and it's all related to this connectivity. So Pasqualeone at Harvard is looking to see if they can suppress some of this hyperconnectivity. The other thing is, a large number of autistic children have learning disorders, and because of this, they were given a treatment for auditory processing disorders just to help them with their learning. And, for instance, autistic parents know that many autistic kids often cover their ears. They're hypersensitive to sounds. That's another sign of potential hyperplasticity, maybe. Mm. And so they did this program, Fast Forward, just to help them with their reading. But anecdotally, parents started reporting that the kids were often being helped with not only their reading, but some of their social problems that had to do with autism and their hypersensitivities. This was completely unanticipated. And in my book in Chapter 3 on the work of Michael Merzenich, I describe his theory as what he thinks is happening in the autistic brain, which is it's a very novel theory to do with a kind of indiscriminate hyperplasticity, where the maps of the brain form in some ways very, very fast, and then they close down before they're very, very detailed, which leads to some of these problems. And he's working on reopening the maps. So I can't – they'd have to take a look at the book and decide if they thought that this particular intervention might be helpful or worth trying, at least not for all of autism, but for some of the symptoms.
That's one idea. The book, The Brain That Changes Itself, is by Norman Deutsch, who has been joining us kindly over the last hour to talk about that amazing thing in the top of our heads. Norman, thanks so much for taking the calls and talking to us about this incredible field of research. I'm sure that we're going to just see it applied more and more widely as it becomes less and less of a new science.
And to make it so simple as well, it's all about use it or lose it. And, you know, your brain is what you do with it. It's incredible.
Yeah, it's inspired me for the rest of the day to get the brain shown.
A whole day you got out of that.
At least till lunchtime.
Well, maybe if I keep reading the book, like neuroplasticity, it'll just keep expanding, you know, the time exponentially. Dr. Norman Deutsch, thanks so much for joining us today on Triple J.
Thank you.
And thank you, Bernie Hobbs, for the last couple of months sitting in for Dr. Carl while
I really felt like I earned my keep today. God, my input there was astonishing, yeah.
We will see you around or, of course, at abc.net.au/science as a regular great science broadcaster. Thanks, Bernie.
No worries. See you, Zan.